creating a talent process that never fails. It's quite a big ask, maybe.
Yes. I do think that there's this idea of we're going to create a great process and it's excellent all of the time and it's going to yield us outstanding outcomes. To me, that is the wrong place to start from. The way you rate a candidate has way more to do about you.
What are you measuring? Like, what are the real like outputs from a metric standpoint? Candidate service, if it's offer acceptance rates, is it, you know, time to hire? Like, what are the...
Yes. And it goes back to what are you trying to optimize for?
Yeah.
How can we become better at very human capabilities like judgment?
This is Hiring on All Cylinders, and I'm your host, Chris Abbas. We bring the leading talent leaders to discuss all things talent trends, insights, and best practices that can level up your organization. Today, I'm joined by Andrew Trout, head of talent at FalconX, a leading digital brokerage. Great to have you, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Awesome. So I thought we'd get stuck in to a very interesting topic. It's quite a punchy subject, which is creating a talent process that never fails. It's quite a big ask, maybe.
Yes.
But I know a lot of leaders are thinking about how to build the best talent practice, obviously in a very competitive market, how to think about that. So I wanted to get your take, maybe a bit about your experience, of how you think about setting up best-in-class hiring processes.
Certainly. Well, I want to give a quick disclaimer in that I promise to contradict myself throughout our conversation today. So hopefully we're all comfortable with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of that ambitious goal, when I think about something that doesn't fail, let's sort of start with that, right? Mm-hmm. And then we'll kind of work through what does it mean to optimize for certain components of a hiring process. And when I hear those words, doesn't fail, I smile because I know that at times it's going to break down and it will fail.
Yeah,
I don't think you can actually build a bulletproof hiring process that 100% of the time gets 100% of the things right.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have to start thinking about what do you want to optimize for and what are you also trying to eliminate, right? So let's start talking about what are you trying to optimize for? Are you trying to optimize for speed? Mm-hmm. Are you trying to optimize for quality? Are you trying to optimize for diversity and inclusion?
Yeah.
Are you trying to optimize for candidate experience? There's a very long list of things that you can try to optimize for in your hiring process, and you cannot have it all the time. And so to work with the stakeholders that you have to go through an alignment process and have a set of commitments around what you're optimizing for and what your goals are. So then it becomes, okay, once you have that conversation, how do you also account for things like bias, right? One of the, and what I also like to talk about, if anybody wants to take me up on it and debate it, when I hear people talk about the like false precision, right? I do think that there's this idea of we're going to create a great process and it's excellent all of the time. And we're going to measure the outcomes and we're going to set up structured interviews and we're going to be 100% confident that this is an amazing process and it's going to yield us outstanding outcomes. To me, that is the wrong place to start from. Mm. It exudes a high degree of overconfidence. And the more time I spend in my career, the more I recognize when I see that around me.
Yeah.
And try to point it out. So I think there's the overconfidence that you can get into, and then the false precision, which is trying to create too much of a scientific process. Mm-hmm. Measuring is great, structure is great. But let's also start that we are dealing with human beings
yeah.
that are fallible. So let's talk about that. What do you want to try to eliminate in your hiring process from a bias perspective, right? We all do interviewer training. We present on a list of 10 or 15 biases that can creep into the process.
Yeah.
Two come to mind immediately, and I've been spending a lot of time with these. One is a concept called idiosyncratic rater bias.
Whoa.
Have you heard that before?
No.
Okay. So this was actually really interesting about 10 years ago. It kind of hit the market, so to speak. And there's two big studies. And the data is, it varies a little bit. But essentially what it means is you as an interviewer come into that interview with a lot of baggage, essentially, a lot of past experience, a set of beliefs. And what these two studies proved was that the way you rate a candidate has way more to do about you than the candidate. This also holds true for internal performance conversations and rating a schema. And somewhere between 54 and 80% of how you rate a candidate has to do with you, the rater, not the candidate.
Right.
So let's start there, right? And recognize that you're going to bring a lot as the interviewer into this. So where do you go from that? You put structure behind it, right? You approach the process with a framework that is directive to that interview in terms of interview focus areas. You're calibrated on what a 5 out of 5 looks like. Mm-hmm. And you have to do that work to build that calibration. So there's a lot you can do to drive better outcomes with a better signal, but also recognize that there's a lot to tackle in any interview process.
So one of the big things I heard you say there is like, it's really important at the beginning to understand what you are and what you're optimizing for and what you're not.
Yes.
And then go through this process, having a very strict process of understanding the biases that you have. So being very clear about the kind of place you're starting from.
Yeah.
Now, it seems like obviously the whole organization's involved in this process, not just TA, not just people. How do you start from that position of everyone being very clear of where you are, agreeing on it, and then moving forwards? Like, how do you get to that place? Because that seems like, you know, fundamentally important, but very difficult. So
we're talking about alignment.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
So one place to start when you enter that conversation and you're in the first step of alignment is, how can you bring people in so that they have a voice? And how can you create an alignment process in which gives them voice and ownership, right? So if you allow for input and voice, generally you will get mutual ownership. Mm-hmm. What I have seen in these situations and when it's failed is it's this thing that the talent acquisition team is doing, and it's very isolated within their group. And then they go through this big, heavy process, and then they tell the world about it. Then they tell stakeholders. I would say, ideally, you can pull those stakeholders in to allow them to influence early and have them take ownership of the end result versus, hey, we didn't shape this, therefore we'll half adopt it.
Right.
So I think that part is essentially, and having some executive stakeholders that early buy in and signal to everyone that this is important.
Yeah.
Right. We're in this work every day, and it's self-serving to say this. And most people agree to this statement that hiring talent is one of the most, if not the most critical components of building a successful business. Mm-hmm. Hard stop. Yeah. So if you start with that and people acknowledge that that is fundamentally true, you can get attention and you can get that input.
Maybe a controversial kind of topic, but that is absolutely true. And I think that the best leaders also recognize how important it is to hire talent.
Yes.
Whether they're in TA or not. Do engineering leaders know how critical it is to their success?
Yes.
Have you, and do you think that leaders should be incentivized to hire great talent and to help with the process and make sure, you know, it runs smoothly and effectively? Have you seen that anywhere? Do you think that should be, you know, part of their compensation structure or incentive structure, if it is so important?
Talentful provides flexible recruiting solutions to the world's most ambitious companies. Are you thinking about ways to add flexibility to your talent function? With recent market volatility and hiring set to return to growth mode in the near future, there's never been a better time to choose the right partner to help you scale. Talentful's embedded sourcing, recruiting, coordination, and talent advisory services have been trusted by the world's leading brands. Companies such as Atlassian, Microsoft, Expedia, Pinterest, Waymo, and more. Whether you're hiring across engineering, go-to-market, or G&A, Talentful has got you covered. To find out how Talentful can help you, visit talentful.com.
I think a lot about incentives, actually. It's typically when we're bringing people in. Mm-hmm. And I do work for an organization that is thoughtful about the incentives because we're incredibly outcome driven. Mm-hmm. So if you start from a place where you are ultimately trying to deliver a specific outcome that contributes to the health and well-being of the company, mm-hmm. whether that's revenue or whether that's profit or whether it's hiring goals, then the short answer is yes. However, I have only seen it done in small slices and never at the company-wide level.
Yeah.
Meaning, what it is, so it is an implicit goal, but it is typically not an explicit outcome that executives or managers are incentivized for.
Yeah.
Now, when it gets most interesting is two things. And actually, Goldman Sachs did this well, in my opinion. They had, in the comp cycle, they had the opportunity to, whether it was formally or informally, recognize certain behaviors that were positive to the overall goals of the company. And it came up in two places. One was for diversity and inclusion related contributions. And that could take on a tremendous shape and arc. And there could have been a lot of behaviors that contributed to that goal. It was a really important goal. The second one was the contributions to the talent selection process. Specifically, when I'll take engineers as an example, who can get pretty grumpy about spending more than 3 or 4 hours a week on interviews. But when you're really scaling, like, that could be your full-time job, right? And so what we did was we actually devised a positive incentive program for those who were contributing the most. And it yielded good results. Mm. But I do think if you're not going to have a specific incentive program, and it wasn't formal, but it was recognized, then having culture carriers who contribute to that, mm-hmm. they should be incentivized and rewarded for doing the work.
Awesome. And, you know, part of having a hiring process that never fails is that you can actually hire great candidates and close them. And in, you know, the companies you've worked in, that's been really hard because you're looking for the top, you know, echelon of talent. What kind of things do you do to really give yourself a competitive edge, you know, inside the process? Because really, you know, I think one of the things that really separates companies and makes candidates feel like part of the company before they've even joined, yeah, and can maybe overcome issues like lower comp and lower stock or whatever else, is how they've been treated and their experience. Because it's a reflection of the organization.
Yes.
Where have you seen that done the best? And like, what experiences have you had in making that process, you know, stand out for candidates?
Yeah, it is. I mean, especially all else being equal, right? Yeah. When the dollars and cents and the location and the remote and the, you know, this is really a powerful lever. And a lot has been said about employer branding and candidate experience. I think there's three levels. Number one is, yes, at the company level, generally, what is your reputation? Mm-hmm. What does Glassdoor say or Blind say? Or, you know, do you show up on one of these best places to work list? Yeah. I think for the savvy consumer, those sources of data are discounted.
Yeah.
Right. We all know what the shortcomings are of using those as a predictor of how you as a person are going to fit or not fit within this culture. Okay. But we're going to continue to make investments there. Right. Secondly, if you actually look at the data, the most telling factor in success, happiness, is your fit with your immediate team. And I actually think that's where the biggest opportunity happens. Mm. Meaning, what is out there on the web about your team leader, your managers, what's on LinkedIn, what's the style, what's the personality, and how can you bring some of that, more of that, into the interview process. Mm. This is challenging for big companies like Facebook who do like generalist hiring, right? Yeah. They're bringing you into a company and then they'll place you on a team later.
Yeah.
But if you have the space to play with that, it can be a really powerful lever. And there's some technologies out there that are also really interesting. So one of the places that has done this really well, and the reason why is we did something called a celebration call. So this was when you received an offer, you infused a little bit of surprise and delight. You got the offer from your recruiter, and then the team who interviewed you came onto a video screen. And each person on the team said in 30 seconds why they're excited to work with you.
Wow.
And the things that you demonstrated in that interview process that got them really excited, right? So layering on that level of specificity, the warmth, the care is really important. And I believe the technology is called Mimeo. I could probably
add. Mimeo.
Yeah. But yeah, and so that's the recording version. I've done it with the live version as well, which takes a lot more calendar coordination. Yeah,
that's awesome. That sounds really awesome. And I think I'll ask this question before I move on to like technology and tools that you just spoke and how that can influence building a great process. But first of all, how do you even determine that it is a great process? Like, you know, we kind of skipped a step here. Like, what are you measuring? Like, what are the real like outputs from a metric standpoint that you can really, you know, dictate this was good, we've done our job? Is it like candidate service? If it is offer acceptance rates, is it, you know, time to hire? Like, what are the...
Yes. And it goes back to what are you trying to optimize for?
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is really interesting is... just to embrace this concept of you're never going to get it 100% right.
Yeah.
Okay. There's been a lot of conversation. So what I like to sort of how I approach this conversation is, especially with executives. Okay, you want to reduce time to hire by 10 days. Sure, we can do it. Mm-hmm. And as a TA leader, I can also say that there are ways to approach the data and the measurement of that metric to, yield a result with not a lot of behavior changes. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the hard thing around data in TA is things are constantly changing. ATSs are changing, process and policies are changing around, you know, what does it like, how do you mark a candidate? When does a candidate actually start being active? And so there's definitely ways to get some behavior change, but it's often around data hygiene.
Yeah.
So then let's focus on the things that probably matter more, which is quality of hire. Mm-hmm. And quality hire, when I've had data sets big enough to measure this, the way that I looked at it was tenure and performance rating, right? So if you believe that those two are signals of quality, then you can create a way that measures backwards on how you got the highest quality hires. Mm. So in that instance specifically, we were actually looking at what source of hire to invest more in, right? Yeah. So when we looked at the data, obviously this is no surprise, referrals were the hires that had the longest tenure and the highest performance.
Could have something to do with them being close to the team.
Yes.
That you mentioned before. Yes. As well.
Yeah. There was just a familiarity there, right? And the person who was recommending that talent knew enough about the company culture, maybe even knew more about the team specifically, and it created a better match. Interestingly, the lowest performing, lowest tenured group was from agency hires, so contingent agencies. And it was also the highest cost to acquire talent. Yeah. So we tried to create a way where we could move those dollars over into a more robust referral program.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's they missold the opportunity, they didn't have enough control over?
Yeah. Okay, so the other concept that I've always talked about in my career is this concept of information asymmetry, where you as a candidate know way more about yourself than a person interviewing you could ever figure out, right? So what I try to do in interviews is actually like build a rapport, like get the guard down a little bit, right? To reduce some of that information asymmetry, because we as a company know way more about ourselves than typically we want to put out there in the world. What I think is interesting about agencies is they're very efficient, like really efficient. And there's probably some ways to kind of game that system a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. And represent both the candidate and the company in a way that makes it seem like a really good fit. Mm-hmm. It's not, I don't doubt the truthfulness or the intent in that. But I just think that the way that those two interact in that relationship with the candidate and an agency is counter to our long-term goal, which is quality and
In agency, you're really not incentivized at all to disqualify. Yeah. Whereas in-house, you really are. Because if someone starts, you sat in the office across from them and your manager's like, well, why did you bring this person in? You know, they're terrible. So there's more impact to you.
Absolutely. And it's really interesting over the arc of my career. I started 10 years as a retained executive recruiter. And when I came in-house for the first time and I went to Square, I didn't recognize enough of the role that you can play as an internal consultant. Mm-hmm. And what I've done beyond past that point was actually get to know the internal talent, because the value that you can create when you compare internal mobility candidates with external is an order of magnitude larger. Mm. And so like I've really put my arms around the internal talent that I'm working with every day. And it's quite common for me now to point to someone internally who I believe in, who I have more signal from to say, I think they're the best person for this role. There's still this instinct to romanticize the other, right? I think we do it in a lot of our relationships, right? There's this person out there that exists in the world, and maybe we call them unicorns in our line of business, but there is this there's still this belief that we hold that someone out there is, you know, this 10X type player, and those people exist, but on average, you know, you probably aren't going to get that.
Makes sense. And speaking of 10X, this seems to be something that's like on a lot of people's minds is how can you leverage technology to, you know, 10X what human beings can do, maybe.
Yes.
And I was just thinking about that in the context of, you know, building a process that never fails. Like, are you seeing anything in regards to automation, technology, or anything that you think in the future could be really useful and could help? My mind, when you were speaking before, went to kind of interview intelligence.
Yes.
You know, like note-taking stuff where you can look at how people are, the consistency in interviews to remove some of that bias. But maybe your opinions on that and anything else that you're seeing at the moment.
Yeah. So look, I'm a techno-optimist, right? I absolutely believe having AI work alongside great talent acquisition talent is the equation that everybody wins. So I'll get specific on tools. So the way that I, early in my career, I would chase the shiny object, right? I would beta test. And I, you know, just the nature of who I am was like, I want to be at the front of the curve and I'm willing to spend some time to be there. But that's really costly from like mostly time, but also the way that impacts other stakeholders internally. So I still love like exploring the best new technology. However, in this game, right? Okay. Let's talk about AI specifically. What we're seeing, because we have an AI tool, like the LLMs and the team with the technology with the most compute power plus data is going to win. Mm-hmm. So very specifically, I was at lunch last week with LinkedIn. It was the COO, the head of product, the VP of thought leadership, and they have the best chance, in my opinion, right? They are now owned by Microsoft, so they have access to OpenAI. Mm-hmm. They have a huge data set. Here's where it gets really interesting, and they did not want to probably hear this from me. Mm-hmm. I've gone really deep on the legality. So in my free time, I have a relationship with Tulane University Law School. And I'm working on a 40-page paper about the intersection of current legal landscape and AI tools and talent selection.
Oh, wow.
LinkedIn is a very public, highly looked at technology. So they're actually disincentivized to be super transparent about where and when they're applying AI tools, right? Because a lot of legal entities are taking a look at this, and there's like three or four recent cases. Meta has been on the receiving end of one of these in, I think, Women Trucker versus Meta, just about like that algorithmic matching. And so, so they're going to be really scrutinized for that.
Yeah.
But they have the best chance and they're already using this in an ethical, legal way, from my understanding, but it's not going to land on our desk as the head of TA as this very like well defined, clearly message that, hey, we're using AI here. Because the best thing I want, honestly, as a TA leader is to be able to say to my CEO when they come to me of like, hey, Andrew, what are we doing with AI as it relates to, all I want to say is like, you know, LinkedIn's got this for us.
Yeah.
That all being said, I loved BrightHire. We have...
Where did you use that?
What's that?
Where did you use
Currently.
Currently, okay.
Yeah, so BrightHire, so Teddy Chestnut, who is a co-founder of BrightHire, was the client manager, account manager at LinkedIn when I was at Goldman.
Right.
So really been exposed to that technology early on. When I was at Google, it would have been impossible to integrate that technology.
Yeah.
But really excited about the capabilities that provides. And when you know you have a good technology, when interviewers and hiring managers are coming to you proactively saying, this is amazing, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, thank goodness. But really like that capability. Look, I also think Eightfold .ai is doing some interesting things. They've been in the game for a while. And yeah, I continue to think, you know, I've used HireVue, which is the automated interviewing platform. They're putting a layer of AI on that. But again, the way that legal policy is shaping up is that application is going to get harder and harder in the sense that it's going to put more burden onto the employer. And the New York law that was passed recently is basically that. It's you have to do a bias audit for any automated or AI-based tool.
And so in the next couple of years, let's say, what kind of application of AI do you think will have the most impact in the hiring process? Is it like interview scheduling? Is it sourcing? Is it this kind of interview analytics and intelligence? Like, do you...
I'll tell you where I want it to be,
yeah.
which is in the matching part.
Right.
Look, I think all the data says, so our application volume has jumped 34% in the last year, right? So clearly we're getting more interest and inbound, but nothing fundamentally has changed with that top of funnel. The impact could be the greatest there, right?
Yeah.
Whether that's screening, sorting. So I'd like it to be there. But I do think where the most traction so far has been in things like Good Time or Modern Time, scheduling, right? And but some of the native apps on like Greenhouse are also pretty good. So I think, yeah, that like high volume, super low task, that's already been it. Impacted. Top of the funnel would be great. And then generally, you know, making better end decisions on assessment and matching is the holy grail.
Fingers crossed someone's listening to this and building something.
Yes.
At this moment.
I hope so.
So before we wrap it up, I wanted to ask you, like, what are you most excited about? You might have answered it already, about the future of talent acquisition from where you sit.
Yeah. So building off the conversation I had last week with the LinkedIn folks is with the technology, right? We're going to automate some of the most basic tasks. Mm-hmm. That means that teams, if they're not smaller, they're going to be focused on higher impact work. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, that means two things. One, how can we become better at very human capabilities? One, like judgment. I've gone pretty deep on how do you actually assess for good judgment for my team specifically, but also for the teams that we're hiring for. So I think this focus on good judgment is really important. What Anish from LinkedIn would say, who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, is this concept around the relationship economy.
Okay.
So how does my team become better at the relationship, both from a candidate side and from a hiring team side, mm-hmm. and making the requisite investments to be really outstanding there? Because at the end of the day, I think that will help deliver those great outcomes, whether that's quality of hire or speed mm-hmm. of hire. And so that's what I'm most excited about. It's the technology layer that unlocks our ability to be the best humans that we're capable of being.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great way to end. I've really enjoyed listening to you talk about this, and I think it was really, really exciting and useful. So thank you very much, Andrew. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the conversation, please remember to like and subscribe so you don't forget any future episodes. See you soon.